Well, I'd like to really welcome you all here tonight. It's a great occasion, and to welcome you to this Sociology Department public lecture given by Professor Bruno Latour. My name's Judy Wiseman. I'm absolutely delighted to be chairing this event this evening. Professor Bruno Latour is a professor at Sciences Po in Paris, but kind of more important for us locally, he's become a centennial professor at the London School of Economics, and that means he's going to be spending much more time with us, we hope, and we're very excited about this. Bruno is one of the world's most foremost sociologists of science, and actually he's been at the vanguard of science studies for over three decades. I'm sure you've all read many of his numerous books. He's had heaps of prestigious prizes, has taught all over the place, and he's an incredibly creative thinker and has taught us lots of things, but certainly he's taught us to think about science as a process, think about science in a different way, as a process in the making, and particularly as a process in the making that's integrally linked to politics. And so we can't think about science and technology in the way that we could pre-Latour. Bruno's an incredibly energetic scholar, and his ideas are constantly evolving, which is what makes him such an exciting thinker. But that can be very problematic, actually, for the legion of students and other scholars who try and walk in his footsteps and apply actor network theory. And what tends to happen, and what the problem is that as soon as they think they've really grasped the theory, they're going to be able to apply actor network theory, Bruno turns around and says, well, actually, it's not really a theory, it's a method. And actually, it's a method that's got really fundamental problems, actually three fundamental flaws. The first one is the word actor, the second one is the word network, and the third one is the word theory. And I hear on the grapevine that you now have a problem with the hyphen between actor and network. Bruno's lecture this evening couldn't be more apposite and topical. It's entitled War and Peace in a Time of Ecological Conflicts. And I must say, I did sort of wonder if you yourself were able to engineer the floods that we've been having in Britain to make this talk even have a greater impact. And I was really struck listening to Radio 4 yesterday morning, which I do in the morning, and the programme came on that's always on Thought for the Day. And there was a pastor actually talking about the rights of rivers to flood, that rivers had sovereignty, that rivers had agency. And I thought to myself, this Frenchman's timing is absolutely impeccable. So join with me in welcoming Bruno Latour.
Thank you very much, Judy. If the world were a bank, they would have already bailed it out. Such is the slogan painted by Greenpeace militant in one of their recent campaigns. It says a lot about our level of intellectual corruption that we don't find such a line simply funny, but tragically realistic. It has the same bleak degree of realism as Frederick Jameson's famous quip that nowadays it seems easier to imagine the end of the world than to imagine the end of capitalism. If you call the world, I mean the one we live in, first nature, and capitalism our second nature, in the sense of that which is totally naturalized, then what those sentences are saying is that the second nature is indeed more solid, less transitory, less perishable than the first. No wonder. The transcendent world of beyond has always been more durable than the poor world of below. But what is new is that this world of beyond is not that of salvation and eternity, but that of economic matters. As Karl Marx would have said, the realm of transcendence has been fully appropriated by banks. For an unexpected turn of phrase, the world of economy, far from representing a sturdy, down-to-earth materialism, a sound appetite for worldly goods and solid matters of fact, is now final and absolute. How mistaken we were! Apparently, it's the laws of capitalism that Jesus had in mind when he warned his disciples, heaven and earth will pass away, but my word will never pass away. This inversion of what is transitory and what is eternal is no longer a joke, especially since what should be called the Australian strategy of voluntary sleepwalking toward catastrophe is being implemented to the full after the last election. No content to dismantle the institution, scientific establishment and instrument that could prepare its constituency to meet the new global threat of climate mutation. The Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, is also dismantling one after the other most department of social sciences and humanities. Such a strategy makes a lot of sense. Not thinking ahead is probably, if you are an Australian, given what is coming, the most rational thing to do. Not thinking seems to be the slogan of the day when you consider that in the United States alone, according to The Guardian, something like $1 billion, yes, $1 billion, is being spent to generate ignorance about the anthropic origin of climate mutation. Prime Minister called it anthropologic origin, actually. In early period, scientists and intellectuals lamented the little money spent on learning. Not at the LSE, of course, with building after building. But never had they to witness floods of money spent on unlearning what was already known. While in time past, thinking critically was associated with looking ahead and extracting oneself from an obscurantist past, today, money is being spent to become even more obscurantist than yesterday. Agnotology, Robert Proctor's science of generating ignorance, has become the most important discipline of the day. It's thanks to this great new science that so many people are able to say to their heart, perish the world, provided my bank survive. So I know it's a desperate task to continue thinking when the powers of intelligence are dedicated to shut down thoughts and to march ahead, eyes wide closed. The spurious debate about climate science is a good indicator of that new situation. On the one hand, there is no debate whatsoever, and no question of natural history has been better settled than that of the anthropic origin of climate change. With the last IPCC report, all nations, it appears, are bracing themselves for the word 4 degrees warmer, and that's the optimist scenario. And yet it is useless to keep saying that there is no discussion. No matter how spurious a controversy, it remains that for a large part of the population there is a controversy, the effect of which we may witness every day through the total inertia of government as well as civil society that are supposed to exert a pressure on their elected proxies. And that's one of the problems that paralyzes politics in this time that we have learned to call the Anthropocene. This is not a rational debate, and that's my point today. Or rather, it is a debate for which the climatologist of the IPCC would have been considered fully rational in another climate earlier, but now they are rendered powerless. They are portrayed as irrational by those who use the power of reason and appeal to the freedom of scientific inquiry to pollute not only the atmosphere, but also the public sphere, to use James Hogan's expression. Why? Because both sides, and this is what produced the idea that there are two sides, use the same science versus politics repertoire, which I will contrast with science with politics repertoire. This repertoire is made of two parts. First, both sides imply that science is about distant, dispassionate facts of nature, while politics is about ideology, passion, and interest, whose intrusion into science cannot do anything but distort the plain fact. Second, both sides agree that policy should follow scientific expertise and that we cannot make decisions based on uncertain science. The difficulty is that this repertoire is shared by most of the public as well. And that means that if any lobbyist paid by the mining or oil industry, or any physicist with his own pet version of what the laws of nature tell him, I say him because they are mostly him, managed to introduce the smallest grain of doubt into the expertise, the whole policy train stops. Part one, Science is about incontrovertible and undisputable fact. Part two, policy follows science. Since this is what all politicians, as well as every onlooker, believe, and since it's also the way TV shows most of the time organize debate, as if they were judges in a courtroom with the two parties, it's incredibly easy to make two sides emerge, even when there is only one. To give credit where credit is due, this should be called the Luntz strategy, to honor Franz Luntz in famous memo to the Republican Party. I quote, "Should the public come to believe that the scientific issues are settled, their views about global warming will change accordingly." Indeed. Therefore, you, the Republican, to continue to make the lack of scientific certainty a primary issue. And his success speaks volume about the mass of money spent to foster climate denial. But it also speaks, and that's my point, to the fragility of the immunological system of those who use the science versus politics repertoire. It appears that the slightest virus is enough to make them doubt and stop policy in its tracks. Because of his weird, even though it's commonsensical, vision of science versus politics, there is no way to immunize the public against such an infectious form of skepticism, this grand adjective that has been most maliciously appropriated. Of course, it would be great if we could imagine that at some point, because of a many public debate about the issue, the two sides would become one. Case settled. Let's now move on to the policy. The apparently innocuous term of skepticism, used so intently by deniers, might seem to lead in such a direction. Let's have a fair and balanced debate, as they say on Fox News. But there's not the slightest chance that this closure will ever occur, since the denier's success is not to win any argument, but simply to make sure that the rest of the public is convinced that there is an argument. How could the poor, helpless climatologist ever win in such a kangaroo court, where the point is not to reach a verdict? The verdict has been reached in the IPCC report that you have read, I'm sure, already. But the new discipline of agnotology has functioned marvelously for cigarettes, as well as for asbestos, and with more resistance for extermination camps. It will work much better and for much longer for climate science, and for one additional reason. It's about the life, daily life, of billions of people, including you. The chance to ever reach closure is nil. And yet waiting for closure before drafting policy is not an option either. This is Achilles' heel of Mr. Luntz's strategy. Not in trying to achieve closure by reasonable debate, the dice are so loaded as long as we pretend they are to science, but in opposing the science versus politics repertoire with what I call a much more reasonable and, I claim, much more rational alternative repertoire. There are two sides, it's true, but not between climatologists and climate deniers. There are two sides between those who stick to a traditional definition of science versus politics and those who have understood that this older political epistemology, as we say in our field, is what renders both politics and science weak. When the issues at stake are too large, for too many interested people directly impacted by the decision. This is where there is a real distinction to be made between what I call a Holocene and an Anthropocene settlement. Holocene and an epistemology and Anthropocene another one. What might have been good for human has lost any sense for those I call earthbound. The great limit of the old settlement was to make impossible any connection with politics and not versus politics. For this, of course, one has to abandon the idea that the only thing politics may do is to distort facts. Although this version of politics is as old as Socrates fighting against Callicles, it flies in the face of everything we expect from politics. building a collective polity on a precisely defined soil or land. Now, more precisely and more extensively, a polity that has an earth under its feet, so to speak. Politics as gravity. I'll come back to the film Gravity in a minute. As decency, when it has a territory to defend. But one should also abandon the idea that science is only about incontrovertible and undisputable fact. Science, with a small s, Judy was alluding to that in a minute ago, is about producing, through the institution of many disciplines and the monitoring of many instruments, robust access to a great number of entities with which the polity has to be built. In this view, both science and politics are mundane, rather humble, frail, and pedestrian activities, open to doubt, revision, and prone to mistake as soon as their delicate operations are not constantly supported. The only thing they cannot afford to do is to work separately. Without the instrument of science, the body politic will never know how many strange entities it has to take into account. And without politics, the same body politic will never know how to array, grade, and rank those bewildering numbers of agency with which it has to progressively compose a common world, which is the definition I propose for politics with science. As I've showed in Politics of Nature, the great paradox of the modern is to have granted to the absolute distinction of science and politics the task of maintaining facts and value as clearly separated as possible. Whereas the connection that has to be carefully stitched together, of course, is exactly orthogonal. It should bring science and politics, plus many other traits, to bear on the two essential tasks. One, defining how many entities have to be taken into account. Two, how can they stand together in a livable form. That's perhaps one comforting thing to say about life in the Anthropocene. It has demonstrated that the ancient settlement was rendered useless as soon as issue became too touchy or concerned too many people. The old settlement worked, if it ever did, only in the rarefied air of outer space for distant problems that interested only a few people and had very indirect, remote consequences. But when action modifies the very framework in which history is supposed to unfold, the idea of distant, disinterested fact becomes less relevant than that of highly disputed matters of concern. So, of course, to shift from science versus politics to science with politics is not without danger. And here the phantom of Karl Popper should probably move here. At first glance, climate deniers will have a field way, clamoring that their adversary have finally confessed what they, on Fox News, have always said. Climate science is politics. To which the only reasonable answer is, yes, of course. Where have you been? And what are you doing yourself? After a minute of hesitation because of the loss of the old settlement, it's not easy to lose confidence in the Maginot line of fact versus value. Well, Maginot line probably says nothing to you. It quickly appears possible to redraw the lines of conflict. Not between two sides of an epistemological debate, on one side the climate science and on the other the climate skeptics, but between two sides, and there will soon be more than two, with a completely different view of what you may expect from science as well as from politics. There is no conflict between science and politics, but there is a conflict between two radically opposite political epistemology, each with its own definition of what science and politics are and how they could collaborate. Of course, there exists plenty of reason for imitating what feminists have called strategic essentialism and to employ, whenever necessary, a form of strategic positivism, as if we could confide to a settled science of the climate the task of serving as an incontrovertible premise for policy. But even if this strategy could succeed, and I don't know if you have followed the response in different countries of the last IPCC report, but it's a complete failure, it will not solve the question, because it will remain a pedagogical gain, not a political one. More people would know for sure, which is always good, but they will not be moved an inch out of a situation of just knowing. We are not dealing here with undisputable matter of fact, but with matters of concern to be disputed. It's a question of knowing uncomfortable fact about pressing issues that concern the very soil on which everybody resides. And in the New York Times, 14 July, Michael Mann wrote a very nice paper, "If you see something, say something." I quote, he's himself, of course, a great scientist. He speaks like all of the climate scientists about his kids. This is, of course, very important. And he crosses happily the fact-value distinction by saying, "This is hardly a radical position. Our Department of Homeland Security has urged citizens to report anything dangerous they witness. If you see something, say something. We scientists are citizens too, and in climate change we see a clear and present danger." That's a nice way to cross the boundary, especially as you probably know that this book is called The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. It should have been clear that expression like "tell it, say it," or "the innocence of carbon," the title of an amazing book by French physicist Denier, as well as that of "uncomfortable fact," straddle the distinction between fact and value. How could it be otherwise? Since we are talking about conflict that pit against one another different definition of a land to which the values politics are attached. How could anyone, I beg you, defend one territory quietly and dispassionately when it's under attack? This is why Michael Mann is so interesting. The only result of the older settlement of fact versus politic is that in such a conflict, one side fights with all the force at its power, while the other side, the rational and reasonable climatologist, must fight with their hands tied behind their back by the injunction that they, and they alone, should protect the sanctity of science, capital S, against any encroachment of ideology and interest. In the old days, such an alternative political epistemology could have been called relativist. But today it's much clearer that when opponents reach for their gun and mention the science war, it's much fairer and once again more rational to say not a science war, but for sure a war of the worlds. Or rather, a war, for the occupation and definition and composition of what the world, at least with what I call the sublunary planet, and let's give it a name, Gaia, is like. How could we agree on this composition since, depending on the answer, each of us has to move literally to another planet? How could we settle the issue when, depending on the response given, we ally with other people and break sides with others? Paradoxically, it seems that capitalists seem to know what it is to grab, to possess, and to defend land more than their spaceless adversaries who have to defend science and view from nowhere for inhabitants of no place. At least they know, the capitalists, to which soil they pertain better than those who keep defending themselves by an appeal to the extraterritorial authority of science. Remember the Bush's war cry, "Americans are from Mars, Europeans are from Venus." Well, it seems that those traditionally defined nations are neither from Mars nor from Venus, but some are from an Earth which has a specific shape, and some are from another Earth, or maybe from a land of no land called Utopia, the Utopia that the modern have imagined as their only future. A future that now looks just like the destroyed space station, and here I talk of gravity, I'm sure you were waiting for that, which Dr. Ryan Stone tries to escape from in the blockbuster film Gravity. The main character, Dr. Ryan Stone, confesses it at one point. I hate space. She says while trying to run from one destroyed space station to the next. I won't tell you the end. Even more forcefully. Well, actually, I will tell you the end. I need the end for that. Even more forcefully than in Cameron's Avatar, the characters and the spectators with them realize there is no longer any frontier. No escape, except back on Earth. The direction is not forward plus ultra, but inward plus intra, back home. When Ryan, sole survivor of a space adventure, reached, I should not say that, the shore of a lake when she has finally landed, she grasped a handful of dirt and mud. She has been literally metamorphosed from a human to an earthbound. While the old-fashioned American hero, played rather croonishly by their teammate George Clooney, has vanished forever in outer space, debris among the debris of a European and Chinese space station. Much as in Von Trier's Melancholia, in Gravity we witness the step-by-step destruction of all Galilean idea of the Earth as one body among other spatial bodies. We are forced to turn our gaze back to sublunar Gaia, so actively modified by human action that it entered this period that we call Anthropocene. Fortunately, it's not true that the general public, the one that is so easily contaminated by loons, is endowed with the sole repertoire of science versus politics. Most of them are ordinary people like us who act most of the time in a universe made of uncertain facts that concern them a lot. Before investing in a company, having children, buying travel insurance, they don't wait for completely incontrovertible evidence and only then jump into action. If there is one thing everybody can understand, it's that when their life is put into question, when the territory in which they live is threatened, when they are attacked by other people who want their place, their land, their soil, their cherished plot of earth, what used to be called their motherland, they certainly don't wait for experts to agree. They need to quickly identify those who can help. And those, is there another word for it, who risk betraying them. Dispatch from a front line, said Mikhail's man. Making decision among contradictory evidence about pressing issue, this attitude is common to scientists, politicians, and ordinary members of the public. Such a common sense attitude takes full force when their territory is under threat. What could be called mobilization is an uneasy, worrisome, yes, dangerous feeling, a source of ill-defined consequences. But one thing is sure, in case of war, the attitude is not of complacency, appeasement, and delegation to the expert. It's bizarre that militant as well as concerned scientists, which is the label, as you know, invented during the virtual nuclear holocaust, could simultaneously complain about the lack of mobilization of the public while trying to euphemize the conflict by shunning away from the dangerous word war. Their adversary have no such qualms. For them, it is a forceful land grab, land name. The land is theirs, and they hold to it fast. That they try to hide behind the mantle of science is a simple ploy. We should not be surprised by this appeal to science. That Gott mit uns has always been embroidered on the banners of earlier war party. It doesn't mean that God ever sided with any of the warring party. Agree it's perilous to speak about war when there is a state of peace. But it's even more dangerous to deny that there is a state of war when you are under attack. Appeaser risk being the denier. Not by denial of climate science this time, but denying that there is a war for the definition and control of a world we collectively try to inhabit. And there is indeed a war for the definition and control of the earth. A war that pits, to be a bit dramatic, human living in the Holocene against earthbound living in the Anthropocene, if you want to trace the front line. What I take to be the clarifying effect of stating this is that it makes possible for the various camp to fly under their own colors, to use Walter Lippmann's expression, and not under the flag of God, or rather, Natur mit uns. Not Latour mit uns. When you meet climate skeptics who have the nerve to call the IPCC a lobby, it would be much more powerful, it seems to me, to answer, of course it is a lobby. Now, let us see how many are you. Where does your money come from? And since we are at it, since you are accusing us of being biased by an ideology, let's put everything on the table. In what world do you live? With what resources? For how long? What future do you envision for your kids? What sort of education do you wish to give them? In which landscape do you wish them to live? Such a counterattack is exactly the opposite of retracting being the science unpolluted by politics strategy. Of course, this geography, or rather this Gaia-graphy, requires a description, as Mann said, of the front lines. For such a delineation, we need all the resources of all the discipline, be they social or natural. Please delineate what you are defending. What do you think the land is worth? With what other organism? What sort of soil? What sort of landscape? What sort of industry? What sort of commerce you wish to survive with? For instance, let us pit innocent carbon, which is the title of his physicist book, against carbon democracy, the title of very important Timothy Mitchell's book, since both straddle the fact-value distinction. In both accounts, carbon does not play the same role, does not receive the same qualification, does not have the same property. Fine. This doesn't prove any distortion of scientific fact. It means that there are many ways for carbon to be composed in the common world. After all, if the same atoms can generate materials as different as graphite and diamond, should we be surprised that the same carbon in the hands of a climate denier has different arrangement and virtues, that is, different agency, that in those of Mitchell, who is an historian of the Middle East oil? Here's a slightly provocative sentence. Innocence and guilt are properties of atom that very exactly, very literally, depend on their composition. I was slightly worried to say that here, but since I'm starting a research project with a chemist from Paris 7, Marc Robert, and he said, we were doing with Sciences Po and him, because we are in the same group now, and he said, well, you know what I want to know is understand why, how is it possible to compose a unity of CO2? And I said, yes, CO2 is completely complicated because there is the CO2 of people who do the economists organize. No, he said, no. We don't have the same CO2 between chemists, biologists, soil scientists, and I'd like you, science studies people, to do a geopolitic maps of CO2, which I find very interesting project. All those connections, what John Tresh calls those cosmogram, can be made explicit only if we don't break them according to the science versus politics by saying, for example, there is the CO2 of science and the CO2 of politics, which would be ridiculous. Of course, such geopolitics, or rather such Gaia politics, as I call it, does not correspond to the old colored map over which so many wars have been waged. The border lines are difficult to detect, but it doesn't mean that it's not about territories. That those new maps don't have to be drawn, and that it's not about conflict. How could we introduce the concept of the Anthropocene and not to draw the consequence in terms of politics of the earth? Mines, rivers, pollution, ocean, fish, fowl, grass, bugs, clouds, rain, floats. Float! They're all there. What is a territory? If it's not that without which you would not be able to live. Well, list all those beings, those agencies you cannot do without. And we will do ours. Then we will draw the territories that are under attack, those that are worth defending, those that could be abandoned. Once this is done, we might compare our chance of losing or winning. Since appeals to nature known by science and its law, what I call the older state of nature, does not bring peace even in the case of such a hardened fact as that of the anthropic origin of climate change, then we should accept living in a declared science state of war. And anyway, our opponents are more attuned to what is at stake. Better verse in what the word possession and defense of one's possession means. They, that is our adversary, mobilized long ago. The real advantage, of course, of making the state of war explicit instead of undeclared is that it might be the only way to begin to envisage peace. But not a pedagogical peace obtained through the older science versus politic repertoire, as if we could begin to discuss policy now that we have all learned the natural sciences so that we necessarily agree with one another about what the world is made of. But instead, a political peace. Again, politics with science, not versus science. One negotiated by the camp, who having exhausted all other options and knowing that neither the God nor the nature embroidered on their banners are really behind them, attempt a settlement, and that's a key point, as if there was no arbiter above their heads. This is the point which I should bring Carl Schmitt. The main difference between the two forms of peace, as Schmitt agreed, is that the pedagogical one comes before any war. War is simply the irrational mistake of those who have not understood the laws of nature or of economics. And peace will be brought back once everyone will have learned the truth about what things are and always have been. So pedagogical peace is akin to what he calls police intervention, or what we now call today governance. By contrast, political peace comes after the war has exhausted the warring party and end up composing what is exactly named a modus vivendi. That is an entangled set of makeshift arrangements to survive. It's because the political peace is not dictated by what is already there, but by what should be progressively realized that there is no way to delay it anymore. Delay is part of a modernist dream. Actually, it's their definition of a future. He's very interested in the book by this gentleman you just hired, I think, Graber. A future made of nothing but a flight from the past and eyes wide shut to what is coming. This is where the concept of a politic with science instead of politic versus science reforms time as well as space. The same way that science with politics propose a different
spatial.
English is not my language. Grounding for Earth each warring camp, it offers another temporal rhythm for action. Action cannot be delayed because time does not flow from the present to the future as if we had to choose between different scenarios hoping for the best. But as if time flowed from what is coming to the present, which is another way to consider the times in which we should live as, dangerous word, apocalyptic. Not in the sense of a catastrophe, although it might be that also, but in the sense of a revelation of things that are coming toward us, not in the other direction. This odd situation of living at the end of time in a different time of hope, the hope that has been made one of the three theological virtues, and that the French, once rarely the case, richer than English, call espérance, to make sure that it's not confused with espoir, hope. Clive Hamilton from Australia, poor guy, has wisely advised us to jettison this espoir, this hope, Because as long as we rely on hope, we still expect to escape from the consequences of our action. His book, I'm sure you know it, Requiem for a Species, is not the funniest book to read. And the whole argument is that you should eradicate hope before you do anything. And he wrote this book long before the election. It's only once we have radically changed our relation to time, what is called living in apocalyptic time, that we might be spurred into action without delay. The times are fulfilled. Historians of ecology are right to say that there is probably nothing completely new in the concept and in the situation of crisis in which we are, that we call the Anthropocene. Since conflicts about territories and their resources are as old as the human race, and since warning about the consequence of those land grabs have on the environment as old as the Industrial Revolution, as Fresseau, the French historian, has shown beautifully. What I take to be really new in this situation that Dipesh Chakrabarty called geo-history, or I prefer geo-story, politics and philosophy modifies simultaneously the spatial and temporal frame in which action is being situated. How odd it is that been for the modern to imagine that their materiality could be made of atomic point without spatial extension and of instant without duration. It is this most idealistic definition of matter that is showing now its utopian and toxic character. It is such an odd conception that has been so constantly at odds with the experience of space and time. And that explains why people like Hansen or Mann or Hamilton or many others are moving to this different view of their own science, because they see the warning and the fact simultaneously. If you see it, tell it. It has rejected every impulse that insisted on being from a place and having duration as being nothing but mere subjectivity, poetry, theology, philosophy, to the point that the modernist dream may be defined as a constant fight to replace the subjective space and time by a really rational view of space belonging, strangely enough, to no space and no time. It's fair to say that civilization has been a long fight, mainly lost, of resisting, for good and bad reason, such a definition of a modernizing frontier. Well, now, through a completely unexpected inversion of the respective position of every field of inquiry, the many disciplines of natural history are calling for a return to the spatial condition of the Earth and for an urgent sense that times are fulfilled. Remember the expression that man used. We don't live in nature, we live in Gaia. And it's not a polity either. Gaia is not a political agent. Scientists are now fighting many other battles. They discover totally different friends and foes, very different from a science war. And so do we all. There is no modernizing frontier anymore. Instead, there are so many new lines of conflict that a totally different Gaia politics, to use geopolitics, is now redrawing all the map. So by remixing all the ingredients of what used to be the distinct domain of subjectivity and objectivity, politics and science, the very notion of living in the Anthropocene is indeed an enormous source of confusion, but a welcome source. Like that of Dr. Ryan Stone, our collective return to Earth is a rather traumatic one. But at last we know where we are and what we should fight for. Ah, but we should not have known that all along, no? Memento homo quia pulvis est et in pulverem reverteris. Remember, man, that thou art dust, and unto dust thou shalt return.
Wonderful, thank you. Okay, well, thank you very much for a wonderful talk, as ever. I've heard many Bruno's talks, all wonderful. We've got about half an hour for questions and comments, and we've got roving mics around the place. So perhaps people could put up their hands, and if you would say who you are, that would also be good, just to give us kind of a sense. We'll see how it goes.
If you know the people, you might.
Paolo Quattrone from the University of Edinburgh. Thanks, Bruno, for yet another fantastic
lecture. Can you speak up just a wee bit?
Yep, okay. So I was saying thanks a lot for another great lecture. I liked a lot this idea of science and politics. It's not me, right?
Okay. I can't. Sorry, you'll have to speak. You'll have to speak even louder. I'm telling.
Okay.
You.
So, and science with politics and the parallel that you do with matter of facts and matter of concern. And I work in accounting, and until the 80s, I would say that the entire history of accounting was about representing matters of concern, and it became a practice that represents matter of facts only, I would say, in the 80s with a kind of neoliberal ideology. So I wonder whether the solution to the problems that you are highlighting is just to go back in history. In a sense, it's also what you did in some of your works when you went back to Gabriel Tard to find some solutions to the theoretical problems of A&T. And so I wonder whether going back to history, when the division between nature and non-nature was not there, could be a source of inspiration. And I also wonder whether if we find the solution in the past, what would be the problems in making them practical again? And as a last thing, I do a question I have for you. Is this just because we are getting old, in a sense, and so, you know, with a kind of wisdom, or in the good old times there were good things, and so the solution could be found there, or history could be actually an instrument through which we can look at the future rather than simply looking at the past.
Thanks very much. Did you hear?
I didn't get the last question, but this man is a great historian of accounting, especially of a Jesuit accounting. Well, amazingly good at accounting, and they were very good at counting simultaneously sin, money, everything. And we now have a Pope who is also a Jesuit, so a great accountant. If I understood the question, what the practical, I indicated something which actually I'd like to discuss with the people at the LSE, because it's something which, as you know, the Paris Climate Conference would be in 2015, in December in Paris. And since I will come more often next year, I was trying to imagine what would be student collaboration and professor collaboration between LSE and Sciences Po to do a counters summit during the big summit, which is as big as the Copenhagen and probably as we hope not a catastrophe, but probably before. On that precise point on which you have worked, and I learned a lot from Paolo on accounting, is how do we represent these geopolitical maps? Basically what Mann says, the line dispatch from the front lines. I mean, what are the front line? And if you say, well, we are front line about science because we don't know science, you have already entered the fight and entered it in the wrong place. So the question is, what the alternative? Well, the alternative is to, practical alternative is to find other way of mapping the geopolitical situation, what I call Gaia politics, which is, of course, not territories in the usual sense, but territory in the sense of what makes us, what sustain our existence. And there might be very, very different, intricated things, and we are doing a lot of work in my lab trying to map out this situation. And it has some sort of connection with accounting, in the sense that, like, as you said at the beginning of your question, the accounting, of course, traddled constantly fact and value. It's made for that. So it's a mixture of resources coming from geopolitics, cartography, geography, science studies, big data things, and accounting, I think. So that when you... Because the problem is that we don't know what we fight. We don't even know there is a fight. You need people like Mann in the New York Times to say, look, there is a war going on here. It's not a rational debate. Rationality was what we had before. But now people who are accusing the others of not being rational are the ones for Fox News. There is something wrong here. And the ones who are doing the science are accused to be a lobby. I mean, that's new. Mm-hmm. And $1 billion spent to produce ignorance, that's new too. There were lots of ignorant people before. But we are not paid for producing ignorance. To be paid to produce ignorance is something amazing. I mean, there's a Demosmog blog in Vancouver by the guy Hogan, who follows that very precisely, and it's just amazing. I'm sorry for what I said about the Australian. I hope you
no,
don't.
No, no, no. You're kidding.
It's still your prime minister, but you deserve it.
Because I made fun of actor network theory. You're getting back at me. Sorry, we've got one there, and I think and okay, let's line up there, and then go over there.
Thank you. You've just defined very well how the world is projected. The world that's projected upon us is distorted. What you have not really gone into much detail about is the motivation of the people who are doing the distortion of science and politics. I would argue that is of equal importance, if not more importance, to define that. Thank you.
I'm going to try.
You haven't talked about the motivation of people who are...
You have to be more precise because I can't answer. I just have to say yes, or is it just something else?
You haven't talked about the motivation of people who are.
Basically, it would be good to hear you define the motivation of the people that are spending billions of pounds on distorting climate change. Why would anyone in their right mind want to do that? They have a very clear reason. So, have you investigated that reason?
Okay, right.
Well, but the point is that, I mean, if I don't, the physicist I mentioned wrote this amazing book called Carbon, Innocent Carbon, which is itself an interesting title. He's not paid by anyone. It's really believing that since he is a physicist, he has never published one single paper in the whole topic, a bit like our minister, Alleg, who was a minister of France, I'm sorry to say. They never published any paper, but they say, they are French, of course, so they say, if you have the basic laws of physics, you have everything else in addition. You just deduce. The French, you like that. You deduce from first principle and everything else. It started with Descartes. You remember the beautiful sentence at the beginning of Descartes? I can deduce the sun and the moon and everything else that lives. To which Peggy says, well, probably if this had not existed, he would have difficulty deducing it. But anyway, the French believe that. So he writes a book entirely innocent. So Innocent Carbon is an innocent book. He really believes that he can deduce from the laws of physics that the old guys working full-time, and there are 10,000 of them, and 25,000 men, are just wrong. So it is that's one motivation. And there are lots, of course, of others, which this Demosmog blog does. But I think we should return what are our motivation. So it has to be on the two sides, right? The motivation, I don't really think the motivation will go very far because it is about things which it cannot be, I mean, it's about the land, the sort of appropriation of the land. So I'm not sure that we have to find motives in the climate deniers. We have also to find motives in us. I mean, what do we do? What I call quietism. What do we do with all this knowledge? It's not about knowledge only. It is a moral issue, as Mann says. Now, and that's very new for the scientists. They are very disturbed because they don't know what to do with this moral issue which comes to them. And they are very worried of writing in the great press saying, wait, it's a warning. So we were used to have facts which were constitutive and warning which were performative. And here they have every day in their papers in Nature Climate Change, statement, warning, statement, warning, and they don't know what to do with it. While I try to help. And for once, I'm not accused of being a relativist, because they say, help us. No kidding, I had climate scientists coming to me, Jouzel, a great French scientist from the IPCC last year, say, coming to me and say, we know you have to help us. See? I'm not a relativist in the end.
Hi, I was just wondering if you would agree that, or if you have any views on the fact whether, you know, the way this debate is always presented, i.e., over there you have the scientists and over there you have the politicians and there's bad stuff going on, whether that's not actually the real issue of framing that debate in that sense, and whether the real issue is not that in democratic societies it's an issue of education, and actually more challengingly of intellectual competence of the ordinary citizen to actually understand the nature of that debate so that they can participate in getting towards a solution, i.e. ecological debates revolve around some very, very tricky issues of statistics and in the end of philosophy of science. And if that debate is to go anywhere, it seems to require the impossible, sadly. It seems to require the impossible, sadly, of the democratic average citizen who will never, ever have the education, or if they do, have the intellectual competence across the board to participate in a productive way. And so pretending that it's the politicians over there and the mad scientists who are in pursuit of absolute truth seems to me a very, very mistaken way to present that challenge.
Well, it is mistaken, but your version seems to be exactly as mistaken, if I'm sorry to say, because the education is always good. But I didn't understand what you said about the average citizen, because if there is something which is pretty simple to understand, is that the soil on which you are is going to be whipped out of your feet. I mean, that doesn't require a PhD. What did you say? So what did you say about this?
That is not clear. Unless you understand the nature of the debate, which revolves around statistics and likelihoods of things happening or not, if you have no competence educationally or intellectually to understand that is what it revolves around, and your reference to Fox News is actually very appropriate.
To what?
Fox News.
Then the average citizen has no way of meaningfully contributing to any of this.
Oh, okay. I understand what you say. You mean, okay, then I, of course, agree. But don't forget, it's not a question of education. I mean, it is, of course, also a question of education, but that would be a pedagogical version. You could have everybody understanding the statistics of climate change and the high atmosphere. It will not move an inch. The question of what, first, policy, of course, but also, it doesn't mean that we would accept to change our way of living. So I think that's what the Anthropocene is about, is that you are in a situation where the old distinction between the natural science, where you could have distance, and the social sciences, where you were enmeshed into what you were saying, have disappeared. And in the Anthropocene, the distinction is that's exactly the paper, all these papers, simultaneously warning and matters of fact. So I agree with you, of course, the theater, that's why I actually wrote a play about it, the theater about staging the climate debate makes impossible, but it's not because people can't understand it. First, because they can, and second, because it's not just understanding. It's resisting a power grab, a land grab, a land armor. So it is something I think that you alluded to the democratic ideal. I think defending your country is part of a democratic, everyone can understand.
Okay. Could you say who you are, actually?
Yes.
I mean.
Yes. My name's Ian Boll. I work at Mayday Rooms, which is a safe haven for archives of dissent here in London, and also at the University of California at Berkeley. I'd just like to say that I was gratified to hear that agnotology was, that you declared agnotology the most important science of the day. And people might be interested to know about how Robert Proctor came to this term. And it was in discussions that I was in. And in fact, I'm actually responsible for the word itself as a recovering...
Well, I don't congratulate you. It's pretty horrible.
As a recovering... I know. As a recovering classicist. It was when he was looking in the archives of the tobacco industry.
Yeah, right.
Right. And came across the famous memo by Brown and Williamson, their own laboratories, which in this memo was the extraordinary line, "Doubt is our product." That's to say, as it were, smokescreen was a product. And for those trained, of course, in standard epistemology, this was a shock, the idea that, you know, laboratories should be producing light rather than the construction of ignorance. So I think that's what started it. And, of course, now it is, a field that's very important. Could you just say, Bruno, what for you are the contours of a political epistemology, given that the old view of knowledge-making is no longer adequate?
Political epistemology is a term I introduced in Pandora's Hope, which is a summary of our field of science studies, which is whenever you talk about science, you simultaneously, as a shadow, define politics. So the divide. So in fact, on top of a debate between science and politics, there is another one, which I call a constitution, which distributes roles and function and values and virtue between the two. And then there are two political epistemology. One that says, bracket, political epistemology, so that the serious philosophy of science, partly done in this institution. And then there is political epistemology, which is STS in a way, that doesn't make the parenthesis and say, okay, when you state your definition of science, state also your definition of politics, because you do the two together. And of course, this is itself linked to a philosophical argument about the distribution of ontology, this time of force between nature and culture. And beyond that, there is a third philosophical argument, which is that of Whitehead, about the bifurcation of nature between primary and secondary qualities. So there are three different arguments, and I sum it up in political epistemology. Just to remind that when you talk about science, you always simultaneously define what politics is. And if you change the definition of science, then that might also change the definition of politics. For example, the idea that science, politics is always the distortion of what would go straight is one of the first lessons of our field by David Blow almost 40 years ago. Now, the alternative is difficult to find. If politics is not distorting science, then what it does? And I propose in Politics of Nature to say, well, probably the fact-value distinction does not capture. And it was very bizarre 10 years ago, but now, of course, all the climate scientists are sort of trying to figure out the same thing. Does that clarify?
Yeah.
By the way, do you confirm the $1 billion of a Guardian, if you follow... Do you follow this sort of thing?
It's a very low figure. I mean,
it's a low figure?
Wow.
It's even worse than I thought.
Okay, we've got two over here, actually.
Yeah.
There's a chap...
Frederick Weisenborn from UCL.
I can't hear, sorry.
And I don't see.
Frederick Weisenborn from UCL. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'd like as well to return to the... question of political epistemologies and the transition that you described from the Holocene to the Anthropocene. As you say, these are matters of concerns in the vicinity of which particular body politics may constitute themselves. Now, this is all fine and well, but there is, however, it seems to me, a circle to square in this transition, a crucial problematics, if you will. And the problem is this. In this transition from Holocene to Anthropocene, how do we prevent politics or representation from being reduced to a technocracy, effectively? If it's the scientists telling us what we need to do with our political decisions, how do we keep the true democratic spirit? How do we retain this as we transition from the Holocene to the Anthropocene?
Well, I think it's a very important... there was a whole meeting in Paris in October on that question. I don't think the Anthropocene is a word that is going to last very long because of what, I mean, the Anthropocene might not last long either, I mean, the thing, I mean, because of what you say, which is that the politics of the word Anthropocene is completely obscure because the anthropos of the Anthropocene doesn't exist as a political body. I mean, some of us here might be responsible, but what about, I don't know, Amazonian Indians? They have nothing to do with the Anthropocene. They live in completely different definition of nature. So and Dipesh Chakrabarty also criticized, and Isabel Stengers and many others, for the same reason, that the Anthropocene doesn't have a politic going with it, the concept of Anthropocene, I agree. Now, I'm slightly more charitable with the word because it's invented by geologists. Who are very serious people, and they have this marvelous motto of, you know, by the hammer. I mean, this is a beautiful Nietzschean slogan they have, and it's a homegrown word to try to understand with very serious stratigrapher trying to understand what the hell is happening to the geology of the planet. So in that sense, it has no politics, and I agree with you, it's not any way to relate the Anthropocene with anything like democracy, but it is a way to relate humans and non-human, which is, after all, what I'm always trying to do. And then the question is, what is the democracy at the time of the Anthropocene? Now, the same question works for the Holocene as well. The problem is that it's a double difficulty for political theory. The Holocene political theory, if you can say that, had to deal with fighting humans, but the landscape at least was, the background was somewhat stable. And geologists, the same guy, say it has been stable for 10,000 years, just the time when all of this thing happened. Now, to do politics where, with, in addition, floods, which I didn't create.
No.
Plus climate, plus air, plus land, plus billions, plus... this means that... And it's very strange, actually, that the historicity... I've shown that in the Gifford lecture. It's very funny, but the historicity has shifted. So now you have very quiet... I mean, the sentence I started with is pretty typical. If the word were bank, it would already been bailed out. So we are much more. We have a very long-term, stable, infinite definition of a human... And it's the earth of which, as Chakrabarty has shown, we attribute all of these features of tipping point, activating rhythm, catastrophe, movement, and so on. So that means that democracy has two types of historicity to take into account. The one of a foreground and the one of a former background, which is now in the foreground. So that does not simplify the question of democracy at all, I agree. So I have no answer to your question. But as you know, ecological thought has not been very good with democracy. I mean, Lovelock mentioned that he is for dictatorship. Jonas wanted to have a government of experts. And I'm sure the LSE is preparing the whole technocratic... because that's what they are known for.
Martha.
Yeah. Hi, Bruno. I wanted to ask you a question about the emphasis on land and territory and country in what you're offering us. Because if I'm not mistaken, there are a lot of people who are either deterritorialized or have never had the privilege of having access to land. So what exactly does the approach that you're offering us offer to people who do not have the attachment to land that seems to be required in the account that you give?
Well, not having, I mean, that's precisely the very important question of climatic migration. Is this what you allude to? Which is, of course, one of the big issues, one of the main issues. We have a whole laboratory in Sciences Po working on that, which is the entire countries where the land is actually disappearing from the feet. So after the long history, Holocene history, of deterritorialization, elimination, expropriation, and so on, there is now another one. And that's why I use the word land grab, because it's a very, it's a way to remind us that when we talk about having a down-to-earth definition of politics, the earth itself, where we are, might be sort of disappearing under our feet. So in a way, the question you raised, which was about people without territory, has to be extended. There are people whose territory has been shifted under their feet. And the question of reoccupying territory, it's a big question actually in England, the question of meandering rivers and floods and so on, which is a sort of luxury example compared to the one you mentioned. All sort of question of geography and geology and land grab and occupation are now back, so to speak, central to the definition of what it is to be on a soil. Maybe land is not a good word, on the soil. I use it in the sense of Schmidt in the nomos of the earth, of course, not in the Euclidean definition of what it is to be on a soil.
There's somebody right at the front, actually.
This gentleman is from Gosmith. He told me. There's no special.
We think here there is a special.
No, there's no way to recognize a goldsmith. I don't think.
Yes, I am goldsmith. My name is Nicholas Liakis. I just wanted to ask, if the messages are coming from the front lines, and the front lines is a scientist speaking, this subject agent who's speaking, then is urgency. Is urgency the front line? Is urgency the material in which this scientist is speaking? Because if there is an epistemological package that needs to be given to people, it must be this rhetorical urgency rather than some sort of formulation of how or constituents of that urgency. So the question would be, yes, is if the constituent is only a materialization or a diegetic structuring of urgency, and if so, actually gets back to the question from up there. What are the professional constraints of giving
what is
that
what?
Urgency?
What is what?
What are the constraints of giving that urgency to another person, to people?
Agency on urgency.
Urgency.
Urgency. Urgency. I mean.
And not agency. You mean, why do I use rhetoric to insist on urgency?
If this isn't a scientific debate, if this has gone beyond that, and we've even seen that with all the forceful language of urgency has failed, as we've seen, because there seems to be an urgency of the threat from Fox or the threat from other news sources, from people like Fox. How do we proceed beyond urgency? How do we construct an argument that has still has the constituent restraints of a threat, but without urgency?
You mean being quiet and wait?
I think they're diametrically opposed.
Well, that's interesting because, of course, there is a great... I mean, this is a point that every single people working on this question mentioned, that urgency has to be itself worked out very, very precisely. Mm-hmm. That's why... Because, of course, it terrifies. And actually, Clive Hamilton has written a whole book on that. There is this absolutely stunning book on the end of the war, the world war in Germany, The Defeat, I think it's called in English, where they show that every single body from the general to the last soldiers knew the war was lost in Germany. And that they maintain the system until the very last minute. The book starts with a stunning description of a village where the Nazis are still able to hang someone, and you, while they hear the American guns coming a few kilometers away, and the guy says, "Well, we should just wave a white flag to save our village," is arrested, tried, hanged. The rope falls. He flees. The villagers catch him up. Put him back, hang him. The Nazi flee, the American enter an hour later. So terror, terrifying people, is the last thing. I mean, I think it's the Australian strategy, I guess, right? Is that never... No, but the threat... I hold all that from Clive. I mean, the threat this year has never been that strong. And it's just the year when they destroy and cut the funding of the agencies in charge of finding the thing. So you're right that it's not urgency. But quietism is another solution, which is probably not good. That's why I think there are lots of people like Michael Northcott and lots of theologians are reinterpreting this old tradition of the apocalyptic time. Not because of a catastrophic connotation, but because of its urgency is also a different time in which you see things coming and then you can act. So it's not really urgency, and it's linked to the question of space, of course. It's being in a different time and space. And I think that's where the tendency... And you said something which is, I hope not what I said. I didn't say it's beyond a scientific debate. Because on the contrary, the scientific debate has to be continued and increased. But if you do like many congressmen want to cut the funding for the satellite on climate, I mean, that's something which has to be fought. If you don't have, of course, it makes perfect sense to destroy all of the alarms. And the word alarms, at least, what do you mean of an alarm? Is it an urgency thing? When you have an alarm, it just rings. All of those words which we use to separate urgency, disinterestedness, matters of fact, matters of concern, are all being mixed because of this new situation.
Maybe we'll just take the very last two together, because I've got one here and three. Can we cope with three, the last three together? Yeah. Very short, huh?
Ben Baumberg, University of Kent, and a visiting fellow here. I like the distinction of facts versus, of science versus politics, as opposed to science with politics. But I was intrigued about where the science fits into your politics with science. It sounds very much to me as if it's conventional politics, except that scientists realise they have to be involved. So if you could explain a bit more about what politics with science, where is the science in it?
Where's the politics with the science? I just want to take two others very quickly because we've got drinks outside. I'm about to invite you all to a reception.
Mine's actually a relatively simple question, as I'm just a simple member of the public come to the lecture tonight. But if we accept that we are all, that politics and science are linked and that we're all essentially lobbyists or advocates for the... for climate science, what one piece of advice would you give us to further the cause of climate science or to promote the lobby or promote our lobbying efforts?
What should we do? What's the piece of advice? What should we do? And quickly, last one.
Sharon Jackson, LSC, social psychology, working on climate change in Tanzania.
Can you speak up?
Sharon Jackson, LSC, social psychology, working on climate change. You asked where the front lines would be. I would say that they're going to be in a lot of ways the same places that they've always been, with the poorest people and the most marginalised countries. That's who's really suffering from the and is going to suffer from climate change. But that's a comment. But the question is, what do you think are some of the dangers of using the metaphor of war when, if one side wins that war, they also sort of complete their own destruction, as well as the opposing side?
Well, I understood the third one at least.
Good. Let's go with that.
I think you're very right. I multiplied the thing that it's dangerous to use the word war. But again, it's dangerous when you invent war in time of peace. But and of course, it's also dangerous, as Marta mentioned, to use the word soil, because it has lots of connotation, and also apocalyptic. It has lots of... and it would be much better not to use any of those terms, of course. Then we would say, well, there is a policy question, there is somewhat of a threat, which is known by science. Let's get together and let's try to work out in the best ways and make a decision. And actually, this situation about climate existed before, at the end of the 20th century. What made me use these words is the extraordinary transformation of the situation in the last 20 years. I'm not the one who invented the notion of war. I mean, this is the book by man. I know it's dangerous, but the problem is that it's less dangerous than pedagogy. If pedagogy fails, I mean, this was the second question, I think. Because if you have a pedagogy definition of what the world of all these things are, they are made to fail. It's just an information which is supposed to be spread, and we all become rational, and then we agree. Well, the climate spurious dispute proves that this model that is expecting peace from the extension of rational discussion has failed. And this time not because it's not diffused enough, but because the people who attack, the scientists are themselves physicists, chemists. Some of them are paid, but many of them are not. So it means that the whole regime by which we used to allocate this division between science and politics, seems to me, is becoming moot. Then, of course, the alternative which I presented is a bricolage. But bricolage is what intellectuals, especially French intellectuals, are supposed to do. Right?
Indeed. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you all for coming.